This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Back in 1969, I took a poetry class that I'll never forget. It was at the State University of New York at Buffalo. Almost every week, it seemed, the teacher brought in a guest poet to read. Poets like Allen Ginsberg, Gregory Corso, Ed Dorn, and Denise Levertov. And each reading was an event you wouldn't want to miss. The teacher was a young poet named Robert Haas. I never got to know him. After all, the class was in one of those big lecture halls. Well, Robert Haas went on to win the Yale Younger Poets Award in 1972 and wrote several other acclaimed collections. He's also translated poems by the Czech writer Czeslaw Miloš. Haas has a new book of poems called Human Wishes, so I thought this would be a good time to talk with him about his poetry. He lives in the San Francisco area, and we invited him to the studios of KQED. Poet Carolyn Kaiser reviewed Human Wishes in the New York Times. She described Haas as a poet of domestic passion for children, friends, the household, the neighborhood, for women as lovers, women as friends. I asked Haas if he thought that was an accurate description.
I think that it's certainly true of one side of my work. I write a lot about family life, or have written a lot about family life.
Why do you think?
Well, I think there are a couple of reasons, but one is just that it was what was given to me to write about in a certain way. I married when I was young, and I had kids, and so it was the life that I wrote out of. I also think that starting to write in the Vietnam years, there was such a sense of violence in the world around that in some maybe predictable middle-class way, I found myself writing about and out of the family as a center of life from which which was both safe from and imperiled by the sense of violence in the world around.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a poem that I'd like you to read an excerpt from, and this poem has a lot to do with family. Would you put this excerpt in context for us?
Well, this poem is called Santa Barbara Road. It's a poem about family life. It's something like picking up a bunch of developed photographs that you've taken over the years, partly of children. I was trying to convey some of what it was like to live in a family and particularly to do it over time, the way children change and grow up. And this particular section of the poem begins with an announcement of how old my son is. You can tell from where he is in school. So should I read?
Go ahead.
Leaf comes home from the last day of his sophomore year. I'm sitting on the stoop by our half-dug, still-imagined kitchen porch, reading Han Dynasty rhyme prose. He puts a hand on my shoulder, grown to exactly my height and still growing. Dad, he says, I'm not taking any more of this tyrannical bullshit. I read to him from Chia Ya. The great man is without bent. A million changes are as one to him. He says, and another thing, don't lay your Buddhist trips on me. The span of life is faded. Man cannot guess its ending. In stillness like the stillness of deep springs. In the kitchen, he flips the lid of the blueberry yogurt. I am thinking this project is more work than I want. Joining, scattering, ebbing and flowing. Where is their persistence? Where is their rule? Bullshit, he mutters. What is the existential reality? He has just read Nausea in Advanced English of all this bullshit, Toto. Toto is the dog. It occurs to me that I may not be a very satisfying parent to rebel against. Like an unmoored boat drifting aimlessly, not even valuing the breath of life, the wise man embraces nothing and drifts with it. I look at his long body in a chair and wonder if I tell him to embrace the void. I think he will embrace a lover soon. I want the stars to terrify him once. I want him to weep bitterly when his grandfather dies, hating the floral carpet, hating it that his old aunts have become expert at an obscene event. I would ward off, if I could, the thicket of grief on grief in which Chia Ya came to entire relinquishment as to a clearing. Digging again, I say, you know, I started this job, and I hate it already, and now I have to finish. He leans against the doorpost with a spoon, takes a mouthful. Well, Pop, he says, that's life.
Tell me what it was like for you to be quoting Eastern poets and philosophers to your son and having him tell you that it was baloney and resisting you.
It was a teasing relationship, I think. And I think it's necessary for teenagers to shake off what their parents have in mind for them. So I actually liked that period in their lives. I mean, I have one who's still a teenager, but I liked that time a lot, that slightly adversarial tugging that went on in those years.
Poet Robert Hass is my guest, and his new collection of poems is called Human Wishes. Asian poetry has influenced your writing a lot, as we could hear in the poem that you just read. How were you first exposed to it?
I think it was in the air in California when I was growing up. When I was in high school, the beat poets were beginning to read in San Francisco and beginning to publish. And so as soon as I started reading the poems of Gary Snyder, that sent me back to the poems of Kenneth Rexroth and his translations of Japanese and Chinese poetry. And Rexroth, in turn, sent me back to Ezra Pound's translation of Chinese. Chinese poetry has been crucial for American poetry in the 20th century, and so it was very much in the air, and probably more so on the West Coast. So it came quite naturally.
I don't know if this is at all accurate or not, but I sometimes think of Chinese and Japanese poetry as about reflecting more on perception, on what is seen, rather than looking inside and being autobiographical or, you know, thinking about something that you've experienced.
Well, there, of course, we're talking about thousands of years of poetry, the two cultures combined,
Right, and what I've said is absurdly general.
But so, if you think about the early Japanese poetry, like the poetry of Lady Komachi, it's a lot like Sappho. It's interior and it's erotic and it's full of longing. But there is a tradition, and it was the tradition that came into American poetry of poetry of perception, especially perception of nature, and it had the quality in English translation anyway of being amazingly clear-headed. And so, just at the time when American poetry was trying to, I think Ezra Pound said, clean the windows of perception, clear the mind, this wonderfully clear-headed, fresh seeing poetry out of Tang Dynasty China began to be translated, and it seemed to a lot of people just what they were looking for in the way of a new way of seeing.
Is that what you wanted too in your poetry, to get that sense of freshness and cleanness?
Well, it almost was tremendously attractive to me at the time that I started writing. You live a life and what you want to get at changes.
Yeah.
And I think maybe when I started writing that work, which was a lot like, in its clarity, the descriptive parts of Hemingway and of a lot of American male writing, it was very appealing to me. And then later, when it came to seem that I just wanted to deal with other more complicated, what did you say, more psychological and interior materials, then I needed another idiom than that. It was true that kind of writing can teach you to, look at the world very freshly and in original ways. But there is in it a bit of, as in something like Hemingway's Big Two-Hearted River, a thing like, I'm describing what I see, you guess what I'm feeling.
Yeah, right.
It was equivalent to the male, yep, nope, thing about feeling that I grew up with. And so then I wanted to find another idiom to talk, as I got to a place where I wanted to deal with other kinds of emotional materials than the haiku wouldn't do, or the four-line Buddhist description of nature.
And what was the other idiom that you found?
I don't know. There are a lot of sources for it. I mean, the first source, in a way, for all of that is always somebody like John Donne. You know, it's the poetry in which you talk about what feeling and talk about ideas. And he had done it. I think, I don't know if it was true for you, but for me, when I was in college, Dunn was the first poet whose voice old poet whose voice sounded human, who kind of grabbed you by the lapel and started talking to you.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've also translated poems by the Polish poet Czesław Miłosz, mm-hmm. and I think of him as being very opposite to Basho and to the Chinese and Japanese poets that have influenced you. Yeah,
he's very interesting. I mean, he has.
I'm saying that because he's a kind of politically engaged poet.
Yeah, he has a double streak in him actually of philosophical and reflexive poetry, but there's a powerful part of him that just wants to describe the world.
In one of your essays about poetry, you wrote, "I started reading European and Latin American poets because I wanted to read a poetry by people who didn't assume that the great drama in their work was that everything in the world was happening to them for the first time."
Well, that's right. And I guess I suppose that was exactly the point at which I began to feel uneasy about what I'd gotten out of American modernism, I guess you'd say, or that part of it that interested me. As with the Chinese poetry and the Japanese poetry, poetry of William Carlos Williams and others, had that feeling of an American beginning. So much depends on the red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens, Williams wrote, seeing things over and over again with a new eye. And somewhere in those years of the late years of the anti-war period and the civil rights movement, when my adolescent anger began to burn off and I began to see these ancient repetitive patterns of violence in the world, I felt like being, you know, morally outraged and surprised all the time wasn't a useful way of looking at the world. And I needed these other voices, the voices that had seen a lot and did not write from the point of view of American freshness, but from a kind of old sense of the world. The poet in whom I found that first was not Miłosz, but Zbigniew Herbert in Miłosz's translation, who wrote about politics with a terrific sense of irony and that was very appealing to me.
We were talking about what sent you off to reading European and Latin American poets. You've translated some work. You've translated the work of Czesław Miłosz, the Polish poet. Has translating poems made you alert to, though I know you've always been alert to this, but more alert to ambiguities in English language?
Oh, yes, it does that. It makes you also alert to how it makes me more aware of how much what kinds of language belong absolutely to what kinds of things you say that you would only say in English and what kinds of things translate.
Can you think of a line that gave you trouble in translating and how you resolved it?
Well, yeah, it's not the funniest story of that kind. I don't know Polish. When I started working with Miłosz on his poems, I knew no Polish at all. And over the years that I've worked, I've learned a little, but not enough so that I could translate with the kind of feel for language that you'd have to translate from Polish. I've always worked either with him or with some other Polish-speaking person, so which added another layer of frustration. It was sort of like... I've thought at times making love with gloves on, you could never quite get at the actual poem. So I would work with a friend. The friend would say, "This line goes, you are an echo that runs, oh dear, the word is tupochum, that runs tupochum through a train or an enfilade of rooms." And I would say, "What does tupochum mean?" And she would say, "Well, it's an onomatopoetic word. It's a word that sounds like what it's supposed to mean." And I said, "Well, what is it supposed to mean?" And she said, "Well, tippy-toe." And I said, "Tippy-toe won't do in English. You don't want to say runs tippy-toe unless it's supposed to be silly. Is it supposed to be? No, it's not supposed to be silly." So she'd say, "Well, this will help. Tupocha in Lithuania is a typical name for a pet hedgehog."
Yeah, that'll help a lot.
Yeah. And so tupochum is sort of the sound that a hedgehog makes running across a hardwood floor. There are things that are just impossible to translate. And I think in that case I ended up with skittering, which isn't very good, but it was the best I could come up with. And then, in the same line, there's the word amphilad, which is in an English dictionary. It means a train of rooms, rooms that open one after another, like a series of French doors opening. And you can use it. And in Polish, they use the word amphilad. It's much fuller of French borrowed words than English is, so it's less odd in Polish than it is in English. So do you say train to give a kind of idea of a railroad, of an elegant railroad flat, or do you say amphilad, which makes it sound more aristocratic than it does in Polish? So you always have these impossible choices. Basically, as everyone says, translation is impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I ended up with "You're an echo that runs skittering through a train of rooms."
Mm.
And then every time I look at it, I think, I should have said amphilad.
You can't win. Let me ask you to read something else from your new collection, Human Wishes. And this is a prose poem called In the Bahamas. And you can introduce it if you'd like, you know, in any way.
Well, I don't think it needs too much introduction.
Okay.
I was working with this little form, the little short paragraph of anecdote or narrative prose, to try to see if I could do something like casual photography in language. In the Bahamas. The doctor looked at her stitches thoughtfully. A tall, lean, white man with an English manner. "Have you ever watched your mum sew?" he asked. "The fellow who did this hadn't. I like to take a tuck on the last stitch. That way the skin doesn't bunch up at the ends. Of course, you can't see the difference, but you can feel it." Later, she asked him about all the one-armed and one-legged black men she kept seeing in the street. "Diabetic gangrene, mostly. There really isn't more of it here than in your country, but there's less prosthesis. It's expensive, of course, and stumps are rather less of a shock when you come right down to it. Well, as we say, there's nothing colorful about the Caribbean." He tapped each black thread into a silver basin as he plucked it out. "Have you ever been to Haiti? Now there is a truly appalling place."
Is this a story that was told to you?
No, it was something. I actually was watching my wife have stitches that were done in the United States removed in the Bahamas, and I was watching this process go on, and it interested me, so I got it down.
Is this in part to you about how people always choose to think things are worse someplace else?
That's right.
Okay. Let me ask you to read another poem. Let me ask you to read Late Spring.
Okay. I think that's another poem about family life.
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is. And all three of my kids show up in it. The Miwok Indians I mention in it were the local peoples of the San Francisco Bay Area. And then in mid-May, the first morning of steady heat, the morning, Leaf says, when you wake up, put on shorts, and that's it for the day. When you pour coffee and walk outside, blinking in the sun. Strawberries have appeared in the markets, and peaches will soon. Squid is so cheap in the fish stores, you begin to consult Japanese and Italian cookbooks for the various and ingenious ways of preparing ika and calamari. And because the light will enlarge your days, your dreams at night will be as strange as the jars of octopus you saw once in a fisherman's boat under the summer moon. And after swimming, white wine, and the sharing of stories before dinner is prolonged because the relations of the children in the neighborhood have acquired village intensity and the stories take longer telling. And there are the nights when the fog rolls in that nobody likes. "Hey, fog," the Miwok sang, "who lived here first. You better go home. Pelican is beating your wife." And after dark, in the first cool hour, your children sleep so heavily in their beds, exhausted from play, it is a pleasure to watch them. Leaf does not move a muscle as he lies there. No, wait, it is Luke who lies there in his 8-year-old body. Leaf is taller than you are, and he isn't home. When he is, his feet will extend past the end of the mattress, and Kristen is at the corner in the dark, talking to neighborhood boys. Things change. There is no need for this dream-compelled narration. The rhythm will keep me awake, changing.
What was the dream-compelled narration? Were you lying awake thinking about this?
Yeah, well, you lie awake playing through your head the life of your family and how it's going, and you can stop telling yourself the story as if it were in some eternal present tense, because it's going to go away. It's going to alter and become some other story.
Oh, one last thing. Since you write so many poems that your family figures into, what's your responsibility to them to not say things that will make them uncomfortable?
Well, I think I've sworn off. You know, it seemed quite natural when they were kids. But in fact, this poem, Santa Barbara Road, that I read part of, I think will be the last of it, because now my kids are mostly grown. In fact, they were here for the holidays, and when I would introduce them to people, some of them would say, people would say, oh, I know you as a character, of course, in your father's poems. And my daughter, who's doing graduate work in Ann Arbor, wandered into a bookstore, and someone asked her if she were my daughter, and she said yes, she was, to the clerk in the bookstore, and he said, were you the one in the dark talking to the neighborhood boys? So she said, knock it off, Dad, okay? So I think enough is enough. You know.
Will you miss that as far as, you know, having a subject?
I'll see. I have up to now written fairly close to the texture of my life, and they still play a large part in it, but their lives change now, you know, I'm not going to write about their relations with their girlfriends and boyfriends and so on. So probably if I do write about them, it will be in different ways, or they'll come into it perhaps in the way that, you know, the friends come into the poems by Horace or someone. Maybe I'll write Horatian poems about how life in California is to them as they're in different parts of the country.
Robert Hess, thank you for talking with us about your poetry.
Well, Terry, it's a pleasure.
Robert Hess's latest collection of poems, Human Wishes, is published by Echo Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.